At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How do you know? I mean, how do you really know what's important and what's not when you're trying to figure out where the economy's going? There are lots of ways. One of our favorites is trying to sneak inside Ben Bernanke's head. It's crowded in there, but enlightening, too. Inflation today, and why the Fed chairman's so uptight about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It's the last day of April today, and we fully understand this is no way to start a radio program, but we are here today to talk about personal consumption expenditures. It does sound boring, and nobody's going to argue that. But it also happens to be a key inflation indicator. Today's number from the Commerce Department is setting off alarm bells about rising prices. It shows prices rose 2.4% in March. That's over a year ago. And that adjusting for those price increases, consumer spending was actually down last month in terms of what we got for our money. As Marketplace's Bob Moon tells us, that's exactly the kind of thing that keeps Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke up at night.
The central bankers who set interest rates are most concerned about the part of the personal consumption price index that factors out more volatile food and energy costs. Strip those away and you can see how those costs are affecting prices for other things and possibly dragging down consumer spending. So which way will the Fed turn? Will it be tempted to raise rates to control inflation or lower rates to spur that old mainstay of the economy, consumer spending? University of Maryland economist Peter Morici thinks neither.
Dr. Bernanke is stuck between a rock and a hard place. The economy is teetering on the precipice of a recession because of the slump in new home construction. On the other hand, the economy is enduring a great deal of inflation because of conditions in international oil markets and tightness in domestic refining capacity.
Morici says the reason the Fed chairman is so worried is simple. Inflation, he says, is just too high.
2.5% inflation a year is right at the edge of things getting out of control.
But with consumer spending down, Morici believes interest rate policymakers will stay on the sidelines until at least September. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's going to be quite a week for Bernanke and company as they get ready to meet on interest rates next week. They've got auto industry sales figures to digest tomorrow, and the April unemployment report comes out Friday morning. It has been, by all accounts, a fairly calm traffic day in the San Francisco Bay Area. As you've probably heard by now, a gasoline tanker truck caught fire in a major highway interchange over the weekend. It melted an overpass near the Bay Bridge in Oakland. And as managers in the region woke up this morning, many were wondering how they would keep their businesses in business today if their workers couldn't get to work. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Jim Barth got up this morning in the East Bay bracing himself for what some predicted would be the worst commute in almost 18 years.
Well, patience is a virtue, so do the best you can and bring a good book.
Many Bay Area workers would have loved to stay home and telecommute, but for thousands, that wasn't an option.
I do think that a day like today makes employers think.
Kai Feldblum is the director of Workplace Flexibility 2010. She says businesses that encourage telecommuting and invest in flexible workplace technologies frequently do better in emergencies. Stan Smith at Deloitte & Touche says his firm was forced into creating a flexible workplace after 9/11.
Before this, what we would get is I'd have managers say, I understand flexibility. You get to leave early and I get to stay and do your work.
Now Deloitte managers have concrete guidelines that help them oversee remote workers, and they put less value on FaceTime. Kaya Feldblum says sometimes it takes a disaster to promote change, but
hope that our country moves forward on this issue without too many bridge disasters or, God forbid, pandemic flus.
But advocates for more flexible workplaces say most companies are stuck following old traditions that squeeze modern families and leave their businesses poorly prepared for the next disaster. I'm Stephen Henn for Marketplace.
Reuters is a leading news service, and there's word today the company is taking its core product, that is providing the news, and turning it into an investing tool. It's rolling out a software system aimed at institutional investors like mutual funds. It'll scan Reuters articles for positive or negative words about a company, give that article an overall score, zap it to the client, and within milliseconds, that information can automatically trigger a trade. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
One way that computer-triggered trading already works is this. The computer kicks in with a buy or sell order if a stock slips out of a pre-specified price range. Reuters' Richard Brown says their new computer program lets clients' trading systems automatically react to scores given to various articles.
You can actually generate a buy and sell order if it reaches a certain level of positivity or negativity.
But analyst David Easthope of consultancy firm Celent says there are potential pitfalls.
I think the danger with this system is that you have a system that quantifies very precisely, but inaccurately, because there is something that isn't being quantitatively analyzed, and that is sort of the sentiment that resides outside anything that's visible.
The sentiment about a company that resides inside an analyst's head, for instance. Still, Easthope says Reuters is in the right place at the right time. Computer-triggered trading is becoming an increasingly large part of the trading landscape. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Full disclosure time here. I ought to mention we get production support from Reuters. No matter where they get their news, investors let April end with something of a fizzle after a gangbuster couple of days at the end of last week in a month that saw the major indices up 5% or more. It will be the sad music when we get there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What you do in the privacy of your own home is, of course, your business, including what you watch on television. Unless you're a Nielsen family, that is. Then there are a whole bunch of people with a lot of money riding on what you do while you're sitting on the living room couch. Television networks and their advertisers are set to go head-to-head in a couple of weeks over what you watch from that couch. The annual upfronts will happen in mid-May. That's where new pilots are unveiled, old standbys are hyped, and billions in advertising are promised. This year, a new set of ratings could affect those sales and what you see during commercial breaks. Andrea Gardner explains.
So you know that Nielsen measures the viewership of TV shows, and the networks price their ad space according to those ratings. But as digital video recorders like TiVo make ad skipping easier, companies don't want to pay big bucks if viewers are watching a popular show and not watching the commercials. They've long asked Nielsen to measure ad viewership, and they're getting their wish. Media analyst Marissa Gluck says that's put a burden on the networks.
You know, if you got up to go get a snack or go to the bathroom, the network was never responsible for you leaving the room. And in a sense, they're now responsible for you not watching commercials.
The networks are testing ways to lure eyeballs back to these breaks. Their big dog in the fight is the Pod Buster. It's a slice of pure entertainment created by the networks that lasts about 10 seconds and is slipped between the ads and a commercial break. During the comedy Scrubs, NBC ran short interviews with the cast.
Scrubs presents Get to Know Us. Have you ever had a nickname?
The CW network strategy goes one step further. TV executives worked with advertisers to create blocks of entertainment that fill an entire 2-minute commercial break. Advertisers advertisers sponsor both the content and the show it runs on in exchange for a mention during that supersized podbuster. This one, which ran during America's Next Top Model, was a mini style show peppered with beauty tips and a plug for the sponsor, Clairol. Marketing director Rick Haskins says savvy viewers prefer one plug over a string of traditional ads.
Viewers are so used to advertisements, they may not stay through the whole time of the advertising break. With content wraps, they're so engaged that they tend to watch all the way through.
But analyst Marissa Gluck says consumers are smart enough to question why ads and entertainment are blending. I asked her what would work better.
I think the answer is really good commercials that don't seem like commercials. When you have a commercial that's fun and entertaining and is more than just trying to sell you something, people tend to stop and watch.
But scoring an ad hit is rare and out of the network's hands. The CW solution, on the other hand, is undeniably successful. Haskins claims they're holding 100% of the audience. That's why the network will air 20 more of these this spring and more in the fall. If the trend continues, Haskins can even envision the day when companies solely sponsor entire shows, like the good old days of the Colgate Comedy Hour. I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Twenty years ago, two guys quit their law practice and decided to open a pizza place, selling not just run-of-the-mill pies, but gourmet pizzas topped with grilled shrimp or duck sausage. And they sold a lot of them. Larry Flax and Rick Rosenfield turned the California Pizza Kitchen into a half-billion-dollar operation with more than 14,000 employees.
The boss will see you now.
Actually, today on Conversations from the Corner Office, it's the bosses we'll see you now. Flax and Rosenfield have split the top jobs of CEO and chairman of the board right down the middle. Same pay package, same sized offices, same everything. I asked them about it when we sat down at one of their restaurants a couple of weeks ago. Why? Why not just have one guy be the CEO, one guy be the chairman and the president, and sort of divvy things up that way?
Oh, that never would have been our idea.
well, because we were 50-50 partners.
Right.
Take it all the way back to what we were in law. We were 50-50 partners. And that's the concept to this day that we work on.
Who's the decider here, if I could borrow a phrase?
Well, decision-making for the 33 years that we've been business partners has always been the two of us agreeing, and we don't always start from the same place, but we always get to the same place. We have good, healthy debates in front of our senior team. At the end of the day, what I've always said is Larry and I both have healthy egos, but neither one of us have egos vested in being right. And I think that's the secret.
You want to get the right answer, not win.
Besides, we don't actually know whose idea things are anyway, because one comes up with the idea, the other guy molds it, we mold it off each other, and it evolves into some combination of ideas.
Yeah, you start worrying about whose idea was something, you're spending a lot of wasted time.
What are the valid organizational benefits of having the split at the top like that?
You know, what I've always thought is this is the real advantage, because if I were running it alone, it would be very lonely. I'd have to make very lonely decisions. When Larry and I come to a decision together, because we do about every major decision affecting this company, there's a comfort in knowing that it's shared by someone who you really respect.
There must be some drawbacks, though.
I wish I could think of that.
Oh, come on.
Well, I suppose if I think about it, possible negative ramification is we can sometimes be played by our executives like mom and dad. Well, mom said it's okay.
Yeah. There is an opportunity for some wily underling to sort of play you both.
Politics can happen, and we always have to make sure we're talking to each other about what people are talking to us about. Also, as we've grown, the challenges of running the company have grown tremendously to the point where we used to do everything in lockstep together, we now divide up and do different things.
So what's the natural division of labor between you two? Who does what?
Well, right now, Rick is the more, he's always been the more left-brained. He's the guy because we're a public company, right, and you know the kind of intensity with all the new regulations and all the intensity of running a public company is you have to be on your toes every day, all the time, making sure you're dotting the I's and crossing the T's and things. And Rick likes that.
Well, it also naturally fits a lawyer to be able to do that, you know. Larry likes the hands-on operational part, the day-to-day part. And I'm on top of that with him daily and what's going on. But he really loves that hands-on part.
Get into it and create food and work with the food and work with the people and get into the restaurant side of it. It's very much fun.
And when it comes to menu development, we both love menu development. That's, you know, it's interestingly...
It's a clinical term for getting into the test kitchen and throwing stuff on a pizza crust.
It is quite interesting. You know, if we look at our menu as it's evolved over the years, we don't have a master chef at California Pizza Kitchen.
California Pizza Kitchen.
We have food development people that work with us, but probably we've come up with about 95% of the menu items.
When you say we, you mean
Larry and I, yeah.
All right, so I actually, as it happens, I have a menu sitting right here.
Surprise.
There was one. That's right. there was one I wanted to ask you about. A lot of these sound really good. Shrimp on a pizza sounds great, and barbecue chicken has been a great hit.
That's our Big Mac.
I have to ask you about this pear and gorgonzola pizza. Where did that come from? I mean, you know, they're lovely together with a glass of wine, but stuck in an oven?
No, because we started playing with ideas of what's good on salad can be good on pizza. If it tastes good to us, we have the ability now with all the restaurants we have to test anything. If they order it and they like it, great. If they don't order it and don't like it,
but then we
fine.
Measure it as well.
All right, so all the good ones get on the menu. What are some of the ones that you haven't really worked out so well?
Well, it's a great story because it goes back 20 years or so. And Larry's still hurt by it. His egg salad pizza never made it. He picked the wrong time. He came out with the egg salad pizza, then they came out with a cholesterol scare.
Same day. The same day that we opened the test of the egg salad pizza in Brentwood, California, I remember exactly, the report came out from the government on eggs and cholesterol.
But I remember,
it just killed it.
What I always remember is during the early years when people would say, so what's Larry is the biggest disaster that's ever happened? He would say it's the egg salad pizza. I'd say, Larry, that's not exactly a disaster. You made a couple quarts of egg salad and nobody bought it, you know. This was not a financial crisis.
Larry Flax and Rick Rosenfeld are the co-chairman and co-CEOs of the California Pizza Kitchen. Gentlemen, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
We've got more of my interview with California Pizza Kitchen's co-CEOs and conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, what's in your paycheck is all relative.
His plot is smaller than a basketball court, and everything is done by hand. He sells the produce at a nearby market for the local currency. That works out to between $30 and $100 for the year.
But first, let's do the numbers. That mixed economic data Bob Moon told us about sent the markets lower today. The Dow Industrials fell 58 points, 0.4%, to end at 13,062. The NASDAQ lost 32 points. That's 1.25% there to finish at 25.25. The S&P 500 shaved off 11 points, 0.75% to wrap up at 14.82. Target and Home Depot did not have a great day. Target lost 2.33%. Home Depot knocked off 1.5%. Hilton Hotels sagged 3.75%. The second largest hotel chain reported a 9% decline in first quarter profits. Renovations at a New York property didn't help that either. On the sunny side, Radio Shack juiced up almost 5%. The electronics retailer reported good first quarter profits thanks to cost cutting and layoffs. Verizon rang up 0.75%. The communications company beat Wall Street's expectations. William Wrigley Jr. chewed up 7%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org.
Thank you.
Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. NASA gives an update on its spacecraft New Horizons as it zips past our solar system's biggest planet, Jupiter, on its way to Pluto. Automakers report sales figures for April. And which state has the best tasting water in the U.S.? Find out tomorrow during the annual Great American Water Taste Test. Judges will assess which water wins based on clarity, bouquet, and taste. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Paul Wolfowitz spent the day trying to hold on to his job. The beleaguered president of the World Bank told the special committee he acted in good faith when he gave his girlfriend a promotion and a raise, and that the incident is being used in a smear campaign, those are his words, to get rid of him. The bank's board is supposed to make a decision about Wolfowitz's fate later this week. Commentator Amity Schles says you've got to put it all in context.
$193,000 was the number that got Shahariza and Paul Wolfowitz in trouble in the first place. People say it's a girlfriend's salary. By that they mean a mysterious wage not quite tethered to market reality. Colleagues at the bank were irate. But maybe the important fact here wasn't that Riza got a girlfriend's salary. It's that hundreds of World Bank colleagues also do. The bank employs 12,000 people. A senior professional starts at $92,000 and can go up to $168,000. That's what a congressman makes. That was also Riza's pay range. She was reassigned to the State Department after Paul Wolfowitz arrived at the bank to avoid a conflict of interest. But she stayed on the bank's payroll. So the caricature of Riza receiving unheard of compensation is inaccurate. Next come managers. They can make more than $226,000. Some thousand employees are in that range. Riza was on the shortlist to become a manager before she hit the news pages. The next salary level includes directors or senior advisors. They earn as much as $269,000. But that's not all. If you're a non-American bank employee, you take that salary home tax-free. Non-Americans make up three-quarters of the bank staff. Did I mention the private school tuition subsidies that drive the rest of Washington crazy? Now, if the bank were a private bank, it would be the bank's business alone what it paid. But World Bank shareholders are governments, including our government. So there's nothing wrong with taking a good look at every aspect of the World Bank. We know why World Bank staff are targeting Wolfowitz. They want to replace him with someone they consider more competent. But don't discount another factor at the bank. Insiders are spotlighting Wolfowitz to keep the spotlight off themselves.
Amity Schles is a columnist from Bloomberg News. Do take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The incumbent president of Mali is expected to have won a second term once the votes are counted from this weekend's election. It'd be a neat trick if that's what happens, because the Malian economy is basically non-existent. 64% of the people in that West African country live in poverty. Per capita income last year was $470. Do the math, it works out to $1.29 a day. Best guesses are more than 1.5 billion people worldwide live on that amount, or less. Matthew Algio went to one of the most impoverished corners of Mali to find out how they do it.
In a parched field on a blistering hot day, Sumantiki Dumbia is hacking away at the hard earth with a crude hoe. No trees shade him as he carefully plants seeds, which, if Mother Nature cooperates, will grow into cucumbers. After planting several rows, he lowers a bucket into a nearby well, hauls up water, and douses each seed. This is Sumantiki Dumbia's life, in the field by six every morning, planting, watering, And inshallah, he says, God willing, harvesting. His plot is smaller than a basketball court, and everything is done by hand. Besides cucumbers, Dumbia also grows eggplants and onions. He sells the produce at a nearby market for the local currency, known as seifa.
If you have good luck, you can make 50,000 seifa. If you have no luck, you make only 15,000 seifa.
That works out to between $30 and $100 for the year. With that money, Dumbia buys an inexpensive grain called millet to feed himself, his two wives, and 22 children, including his late brother's family. Yet Dumbia is lucky. At least he has a small piece of land to cultivate. All Musa Traore has is a rickety two-wheeled cart and a bedraggled donkey.
This is his donkey. Does he have a name? His name is John Guinea.
John Guinea, it turns out, is also the name of one of Traore's friends. Before dawn every morning, Traore hitches his cart to the donkey and parks along the main road in his village. If he's lucky, somebody will need to move a load of mud bricks or some buckets of water that day, and he will earn $2 to buy some millet for his wife and eight children.
But this is not very frequent. Maybe 2 or 3 days in a week, I can make this.
Traore spends the rest of his time foraging for wood, which he cuts and sells. In Mali, wood is a main fuel source for cooking and heating. It's also a reliable source of income. When the millet runs out, wood is what keeps families fed. When he's not working in his field, Sumantiki Dumbia says he forages for wood.
I put the wood on my bicycle and go in the village of Senu, where I can sell it for 1,000 to 1,050 seifa.
That's a 40-mile round trip for about $2. Foraging for wood has become an environmental problem in Mali. The nation, which is already half desert, is now being deforested at the rate of about 4% a year. Neither Sumantiki Dumbia nor Musa Traore can afford to send all their children to school full time. Technically, elementary education in Mali is free, but supplies must still be purchased, and even pencils are too expensive for some families. So, on many days, Traore's children pass the time sitting in the shade and teasing poor John Guinea. They put some feed on the ground just beyond the reach of the tethered donkey. In Bamako, Mali, I'm Matthew Algio for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Matthew gives us a glimpse of the other side of the fence.
My wife and I have an annual income that is roughly 6,000% higher than the average Malians. To equal this standard of living back home, we'd need to earn more than $2 million a year.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, it's a for sale ad, a 23,000 square foot office complex, to be specific. Includes the office building and cafeteria. Asking price is $6 million. Perhaps I forgot to mention the location, though. It's in the Himalayan foothills. The federal government's getting rid of some, quote, excess property. The former American embassy in Kathmandu, Nepal, is among the 29 properties on the market. According to the Associated Press, the State Department's selling more than $200 million worth of land and buildings around the world. Other gems include the former ambassador's residence in Libya and almost 80 acres of vacant land in Bangkok, Thailand. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 58 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 32 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 dropped 11 points. That is about 0.75% there. If you miss the show every now and then on the radio, we've got a podcast for you if you need it. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Our producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.